As far as the history of franchises in Canada, one is incorrect to assume that it's been a steady progress towards greater enfranchisement. It's described, I believe, in your article as haphazard. One of the things that really jumped out at me when I was reading through the stuff is that initially in Canada, I guess this is pre-Confederation, voting was restricted to quote-unquote loyal British subjects and to, most interestingly, I think, people who were property owners. That's accurate, first of all, right?
Yes, it is. That's a very long-standing English attitude towards the electoral franchise, is that it represents property holders, people of substantial wealth and a fixed interest in the community.
The reason this jumped out at me is I was recalling a statistic from, I think it's the Federation of Metro Tenants Association. So it's a Toronto statistic that says 70% of tenants still don't vote. And I thought it was interesting given this history. Do you have any thoughts about how that's been allowed to continue, at least in practice, if obviously not in law?
Well, I think that the conservative argument, I mean, generic conservative argument over a very long time has been that people who have property in an area have a real interest in that area, and electoral elections have been very locally based through most of their history in the English system. And so maybe there's some truth to that. You know, certainly people who have a lot of money have a very high voter turnout rate compared to people who are broke. And the you can think of a number of reasons for that, but part of it is they the people with money and people with property feel they have a lot to lose and feel they may make a difference. While people who are poor and people who are transient may feel that they don't.
The same can be said, arguably, for other traditionally marginalized communities, some of whom got the vote, I guess, at various times throughout history. One interesting note is that, in fact, property qualifications were brought in after we started having elections in this country. This would still be pre-Confederation.
Early on, British governors wanted to have a responsible body, some sort of a legislature, and they wanted people to be able to vote. They needed a substantial body to vote, and so they created one, even in areas where people did not have freehold land holding of their own, and there were tenants or even squatters. In some areas, they said, well, that'll have to do, because they felt the British system is very much based on the idea that you have some kind of a legislative body representing the most important part of the community. It's one way that support for politics was created, as far back as the 14th century. Now, when there were lots of people who might be able to vote, and they weren't so desperate for voters, they tried to restrict it again. They tried to make sure that people who had a certain amount of property would be the only voters. But early on, in some parts of Canada, there were too many French people around, to be blunt, and too many Catholics around for governors to be all that picky about which loyal Britons they allowed into the electorate. They had to have those loyal Britons. They had to have that legislature. So they made sure people could vote even if they wouldn't have qualified back in England, or even later on in Canadian elections.
What you're saying is Protestants were allowed to vote.
Protestants, yes. This was not just the Canadian issue, but it was an English issue as well, Catholics were disenfranchised in the British Isles, and because they were considered to be potential subversives.
And after Catholics were given the vote, there was still a restriction based on various people's homelands in different parts of the country. Is that right?
Yes. There were particularly areas with Asian immigration. There was an attempt to keep those Asians from having the same rights to vote as other immigrants. There was a big movement in British Columbia, for instance, to keep the country white, basically, by keeping non-whites, as they calculated them, keep them as much out of the political system as they could manage.
That's very disturbing rhetoric, I imagine.
Yes, and it was very common in the interwar period when there was a lot of racial rhetoric all over the world. But I imagine it goes back to before the First World War. There's some famous incidents of trying to keep Indian and Chinese and Japanese immigrants out. I believe there was a group of Sikhs who were not allowed to land in Vancouver at some point before the First World War because people from all over the world were interested in coming to Canada. But there was, the British and white self-identified group was concerned about this and making sure the electoral that the vote was kept away from these people was one way of securing that.
As concerns women and when they were allowed to vote, I had the what turns out to be a mistaken impression that this was something that happened gradually. But once again, in this case, women were actually allowed to vote very early on.
In an area where the British prejudices weren't the sort of the natural law of the land, whatever the laws actually said. In other words, in Quebec, when there were elections introduced into Quebec, women who qualified on whatever franchise was available at the time were allowed to vote for a while. But there was in the 1830s a move to more clearly define the electorate for the right kind of people, and this applies to the United States as well. There were and women were specifically banned. And in fact, you know, people in the United States in various areas, blacks were specifically banned at a time when otherwise they might have been qualified to vote. There was a very definite, strong feeling for universal male suffrage in the pre-Civil War period, the pre-Confederation period up here. Mm-hmm. And in that period, when a lot of people were being given the vote on the basis that they were adult men, as opposed to property owners of a certain level, then you had to say, well, if people don't have to have property to vote, what is the right restriction? And the right restriction, both in Quebec and in Ohio or Tennessee, was, women are not going to be allowed to vote. It's going to be white men. And I don't believe that applied to central Canada, but it did at a later time apply to other parts of Canada. When you widen out the franchise in one dimension, you have to say, well, what are the implications? And the implications for a lot of people were that, well, you can't let women vote. You can't let members of inferior races vote. So we'll have to have a specific rule. In the past, holding property kept most or all of these people out of the electorate, but now we're changing that rule, so you have to come up with a specific restriction.
I suppose it's close to the early 20th century when women across Canada got the right to vote. However, with the, it seems, notable exception of Quebec, where...
Well, women in Quebec could vote in federal elections because there was a federal franchise. In the provincial elections, they couldn't vote. Now, how many of them did when they weren't, when there was definitely this strong feeling against them voting in their home province? It would be interesting to know how many went out and voted for their federal MPs, but they could. Now, the introduction of a wide franchise for women is very interesting because it was part of the Borden government's attempt to fix the election in 1917, well, a successful attempt. It was a matter of conscription was the big issue. The government felt that conscription was absolutely necessary to support the war effort, but that they might lose, not just votes, not just seats in Quebec, but seats in other areas as well. There was very strong feeling against it. So they gave the vote to an awful lot of people who wouldn't have it otherwise, and they took it away from other people to make sure that post-conscription policies were followed. So people who had the vote, who were considered enemy aliens, like Italians or Ukrainians, had the vote taken away from them, while women who were military nurses in France were given the vote. And also widows and wives of serving soldiers were given the vote, and because the government was pretty sure they would vote for the conservatives. After that, it was you couldn't go back. after that, because the idea that women were not suited to the political process was blown out of the water, and there was no argument that would do to keep them from having a vote on a wide basis. Of course, this happened everywhere in the world where there were elections of any sort. There had been a strong feeling among women that they should be allowed to vote before the First World War, and the First World War showed that every single working member of society was absolutely essential in a war effort for national survival. And after that, everybody changed their minds pretty much, with a few exceptions. Women had a public role. It had been demonstrated in the great catastrophe of the First World War.
So this early 20th century example of a massive disenfranchisement is not, although it is common, it was definitely not the first time this had happened in Canada.
No, it was not the first time. It was by far the most blatant and important example for public policy. And it raised such strong feelings that the Borden government created elections, what's now Elections Canada, so that things like this wouldn't happen again. I mean, they themselves, after the war was over, brought in a policy that was a reaction to the undesirable effects of their own policy earlier on. And it had been thought, you know, in the 19th century, the idea that governments would put a lot of pressure on the electoral process one way or another was not at all exotic. But clearly by the early 20th century, the idea of fairer voting procedures was pretty strong. There was a lot of European changes in proportional voting and things of that sort came in the late 19th, early 20th century because people were taking the idea of voting much more seriously, at least in some countries. And when new countries started having competitive elections, they went for the best possible example that they could find, which tended to be, you know, simpler, more universal access to the ballot.
In pre-Confederation Canada, who did and didn't vote was largely the domain of the, I'm not sure that they were called provinces, but colonies certainly at the time.
Yes, it was. In fact, the provinces set the franchise until 1885. And then after that, they set their own franchises, but there was a federally administered franchise.
Which is one of the interesting things that I came across in the reading as well, which was that it was our first prime minister who passed the Electoral Franchise Act, 1885, so within a decade of Confederation.
Yes, and he made it more restrictive, too.
Yes.
Some provinces had a less restrictive franchise, some had a more restrictive, and he went towards the more restrictive.
Can you describe some of the restrictions that were added at that time?
I think it was probably just a strong, I don't know the details, I think it was just a stronger property franchise than some provinces had. I mean, MacDonald was a conservative in the true sense, the 19th century sense of the word, and he thought that the conservatives of that era believed substantial people were responsible people, and those are the ones who should have the vote. And they were completely unapologetic in feeling that way. And it's quite, you know, I would think some of the people who call themselves conservatives today come from a completely different tradition, but that's the true British conservative attitude is keep the franchise restricted and keep the electorate small for the people who can really be trusted to use it properly.
I thought it was interesting from the point of view of John A. MacDonald being, you know, recognized for so many of his monumental achievements, whether it's, I guess, his part in the railway or Confederation itself. So we fast forward to 1920 when there was the reaction, which you've already alluded to, of the rigged, I guess, elections.
It was rigged, no question.
Yeah. Okay, well, a lot of people are saying that about some of our contemporary elections as well. So
I would say that there's not much evidence for that in Canada. I mean, Canada's got a very straightforward, independently administered electoral system.
No, I was actually thinking specifically of the last U.S. election.
Well, yes, the American system is a complete mess. There's nothing like the thing is, the American attitude It's nowhere in any law, but it's in practice all over the place, is that if you can't figure out how to vote and get your vote to count, well, you're probably not one of those people who should be voting anyway. And the second thing about the American system is that this is a perfect example of the American attitude that local solutions are best, which means that every state has a different system, and within states, it's not necessarily uniform either. Now, they have much more complicated elections than we have for a variety of reasons. When we have a parliamentary election on the federal level, that's it. You go in and you vote for your MP. You make one X and it's over. And the people who count those ballots have a very easy time, figuring out what's going on. In the American system, you might be voting on 100 different things on the same day. And it's going to be different in every county or every city or every whatever. So it is complicated. So that preference for the local solution and bundling everything together on one November day had really worked against the system back in 2000. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that should be said is that the American system is perhaps the oldest fashioned electoral system in the entire world. Since it was early on introduced, it hasn't been changed much. It is very old-fashioned, and Canada's is pretty old-fashioned, too, with the first-past-the-post system. Hardly anybody uses that anymore in the entire world. And it may have something, the lack of a first-past-the-post system may have something to do with the drop-off in participation in recent years.
Which has been troubling for a lot of people on both sides, actually, of the debate that we're having about whether to vote or not. It seems that the declining participation or apathy, to be general about it, is a tremendous concern.
Well, I think in the 1990s, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how many people vote this summer. Because this time it really does seem to be completely up in the air who's going to win. And in many writings across the country, there's going to be a real chance that somebody new that you like or don't like will get in if you do or don't show up. Now, nobody last election, everybody knew who was going to win. The election before that, people were pretty sure who was going to win. This is not a big encouraging thing. There was no party to stand up against the Liberals across the country that had any chance of forming the government. But now there is, the NDP is showing more life. So that may be it. On the other hand, there may be a wider cultural thing behind the fall off, which would be kind of hard to define. It was pointed out recently in connection with the D-Day celebrations in the States that Americans who were of military age in the Second World War are amazingly good at voting and very, very much more likely, much more than the average person to be involved in a lot of community organizations. Because you can see why this would be the case. I don't know if there's any parallel study for Canadian people of the same era, but you can see that, they knew that the country was theirs to save or to lose at a crucial point in their lives. And I suspect that a lot of people who are in their 20s in Canada today have never been faced with a big political issue where their vote meant anything to them. I mean, with the exception of people voting in 1995 in Quebec, about separation or whatever it was they were supposedly voting about at that point. What else has there been? I think the issues have not been clear, and all sorts of reasons why your vote doesn't count could be adduced, but, it's hard to find in many cases reasons why your vote would count in the last three federal elections. Though I suspect, it is funny that the election that threw the conservatives out didn't have a particularly huge turnout at that time. But I suspect part of it is that people knew how the election was going to come out that time, too. It was just no surprise. And that's why people didn't show up.
Well, there was a huge backlash, I recall, against Mr. Mulroney's government.
Yes, there was.
Very, very similar, in fact, to what we've seen here in Ontario recently with the backlash against the former conservative government.
Yes.
Although I'm not too sure that in either case the changing of the ruling party led to significant changes in policy.
Yes. Well, that's hard to say. You know, it depends on who you are, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's too early to say in the case of Ontario, certainly.
Yeah. I think that there are definitely times when people are much more strongly motivated by getting people out than they've had their time, and there was a big in 79 when Trudeau lost, there was 75, almost 76% of the registered voters voted that time, which was a big jump from the previous election in 74. And then when Joe Clark's Conservatives blew it and there was a new election almost immediately, and people pretty well knew how that one was going to come out, there was a big drop in voter turnout among the registered voters. It was quite a substantial one, like 6% or 7%. I think people were motivated to go out there and throw them out. On the other hand, when the federal conservatives were knocked out in 93, it was actually a drop in voters from the previous time. So I guess I don't have a good theory.
The numbers were substantially higher, despite the fact that they were somewhat lower for the time, certainly much higher than the last federal election in Canada.
The thing about it is, it's hard to say what these trends mean, or even how much of a trend they are. It would be interesting to know, and unfortunately I don't know what the trends are for provincial turnout in various provinces or in the provinces as a whole. You know, if we had figures that said there's been a drop off in registered voters over the course of the 90s. In all the provincial elections as well. Well, that would really mean much more than three drops in a row on the federal elections, as far as I'm concerned, because I think there are plenty of other factors that can be cited for the drop off. You know, lack of big issues, lack of serious competition for winning.
Do you think it's the lack of big issues? Because I think that there are issues that a large number of people are concerned about that simply are not addressed in the rhetoric leading up to the election.
That's a very good point, and I think that you're right. I guess it isn't the lack of big issues. The lack of big issues on the table.
Right.
I think that's where the first past the post system works against. Modern ideas of electoral behavior. I think we're back in it. We have a 19th century idea that there may be more than two parties, but there are really only two parties, and they are quite distinct. And you vote for the one you vote for. I mean, that worked pretty well in much of Canadian history. But now, if you want to vote for the Greens, well, you can vote for the Greens all you like, and they'll never get an MP in the first past the post system. If there was, on the other hand, if there was a some kind of proportional system, then you very likely could go out and get your guy a green in, or five or six greens in across the country, and people who wanted to vote for the Greens or the Libertarians or whoever would be much more motivated to vote because there was a real chance that even if their local MP wasn't going to be elected, there would be a party list MP that. Sitting there in Ottawa, bringing up the issues that the voter cared about.
So I'm guessing from what you're saying that you heavily favor a system of proportional representation.
It's not so much that I favor it. I think that a lot of people's complaints about the electoral system, the kind that are expressed of the sort that we've been talking about, is that nobody stands for what I want, would be addressed by that. And it is the fact that almost every country in the world uses some kind of system that allows for more electoral choice than people have in Canadian parliamentary elections. You know, we've got the old-fashioned thing that not so far, you know, that worked real well in 1820 or something. But it doesn't. I think, you know, in the total world of electoral behavior, this is not satisfactory for hardly anybody. And people in Canada complain about it quite frequently, that they would like something else, that it isn't right that a party that got 30 or 40% of the vote should be reduced to two seats in the House of Commons. You know, in 93, that was ridiculous. And, that's one of the things I think that has shaped the last decade of Canadian politics, is the Conservatives were wiped out. Sure, people hated Mulroney, but they didn't vote as if they wanted the Conservatives to disappear, yet they did. And there's been plenty of NDP voters over the years who have felt that, you know, I live in the wrong place, there's not a chance that my guy's ever going to get in there. And, you know, they feel underrepresented, and in by one way of calculating, they are. I mean, this is what other people say. The solutions to this particular dissatisfaction are not new. They're 100 years old, and they just haven't been picked up in Canada.
Yet.
And we may be moving that way, and I bet you it would be the provinces that would go that way first.
It'll be interesting to see the change. I wanted to talk to you about, this has gone on for longer than I thought it would. I wanted to talk about the right of prisoners to vote briefly. Do you know, first of all, when did this change? It's a very recent change.
Unfortunately, I haven't kept all that. Yes, it is very recent. Sometime in the last 10 years, and I think it's the actual effectiveness of it. It may not have happened yet. I mean, maybe no prisoners voted yet.
Do you know how that change was brought about at all, or?
I'm afraid I don't.
Okay,
I would wonder, you know, one of the things that's interesting is, I said that in the American system, it's not easy to vote. It's not easy to get registered. And there's not a systematic way of keeping track of the votes that inspires confidence in many areas. In Canada, there has been an institution, Elections Canada, working for a long time, certainly over the last 30 years or so, to make sure that everybody who has the right to vote can exercise it. You know, they actively follow that agenda, and it was written into the Constitution in 1982,
right,
that there is a right to vote. There was never one before that, and there certainly is not a constitutional right to vote in the United States. There never has been. I think the right of prisoners to vote came about because of a trend in constitutional thinking in this country that a lot of people object to, but it's perfectly in line with the idea that society should be more inclusive, and that the government institutions have an obligation to help to implement theoretical rights. I mean, one of the big things that that Elections Canada did, I believe, in the 50s, and maybe it was, I'm not quite sure the date, was to actually make sure that Inuit could vote. You know, in the past, Inuit had the right to vote. At what point, I'm not quite sure, but they weren't anywhere close to a ballot box, so that was it. Elections Canada thought that, you know, went out of its way to make sure that was corrected. And I think, I'm not giving all the credit to Elections Canada, but I think it is part of developing constitutional ideas that Canadians have about elections, which I think will, you know, if we do have a change to some kind of proportional voting, it'll be perfectly in line with that.